Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. There has been a flurry of news reports and commentaries over the Guardian's reports exposing a wide-ranging secret court order that demanded Verizon pass the details of phone calls to the National Security Agency. We also learned about a huge NSA intelligence system called PRISM, which reportedly collects data from the systems of technology companies like Yahoo, Facebook, and Google. The leaks came from 29-year-old Edward Snowden, a former technical assistant for the CIA, an employee of the private contractor Booz Allen Hamilton. That contractor has since fired Snowden. Now, not surprisingly, the media coverage has really been all over the board. But over the past week, the majority of the coverage has focused on whether Snowden is a hero or a traitor. Now, you've got a lot of commentators calling him a traitor. Senator Dianne Feinstein has called him a traitor. Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi says he belongs in jail. Where is the coverage of the details of these systems, private contractors, and really what this means for democracy? Today we're joined by Tim Shorrock, an investigative journalist and author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Outsourced Intelligence. Tim has a story at Salon this week called Meet the Contractors Analyzing Your Private Data, and then one at The Nation, A Modern-Day Stasi State. And Tim writes, when I first heard that the source for Glenn Greenwald's blockbuster stories on the NSA was a contractor working for Booz Allen Hamilton, I felt a surge of vindication. After all, I've been writing about the murky world of intelligence contracting for a decade, and here was finally a sign of how extensively the government has outsourced its most secretive operations. Hi, Tim. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Nice to have you. And we're also joined by David Talbot. He's founder and former editor-in-chief of Salon and author of the new book, Season of the Witch. David is project director of the new venture, Open America. It's an investigative media project dedicated to a free, democratic, and transparent United States. The project was inspired by whistleblowers like Bradley Manning, and David and his team are currently working to raise funds for the project on Indiegogo. And in a piece he wrote for Salon, David writes, there is a growing sense that this is a critical moment for American democracy. A national security state engorged by war on terror spending has encroached so deeply on our civil liberties that unless we fight back now, those cherished freedoms might be lost forever. But many journalists in the independent press feel a sense of solidarity with Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks. That's why I'm joining with a group of dedicated editors and reporters from my days at Salon and Mother Jones magazine to start a new investigative media project that we're calling Open America. And David Talbot joins me here in studio. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rose.
And the protests in Turkey continue after 2 weeks of excessive violence by police. The death toll has risen to 5. Thousands of people have been injured. 2 weeks ago, activists and environmentalists in Turkey took to the streets to protest the redevelopment of Istanbul's Gezi Park, the last green space in the center of the city. Since then, tens of thousands of people have expressed anger at Prime Minister Erdogan and his authoritarian rule. And we're joined by Justin Vella, freelance reporter based in Istanbul. Hi, Justin. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So as we always do, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Tim, let's start with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, you know, I think the mainstream press has done okay, but not really great in terms of covering this story. I mean, of course, I have to applaud the Guardian's, you know, amazing reporting on this. But I think really, in my mind, the best reporter has been blogger Marcy Wheeler, who blogs at Empty Wheel, who's just always on top of these issues. And over the last couple days in particular, she's really kind of unraveled, you know, the statements made by General Alexander, head of the NSA, at a hearing the other day, and also a lot of what the Congress people have been saying and pointing out the contradictions and, you know, absolute, you know, false statements that some of these people have made. And you know, I really commend her for her reporting.
All right. So kudos to Marcy Wheeler. What is her background, Tim? Because she is getting a lot of attention for her reporting on this issue. Do you know?
Well, you know, she's been writing on this for years. I mean, she's like, for example, she's a person who, you know, what she does is she goes through the details of reports, kind of like I.F. Stone used to do, you know, find, you know, details no one was looking for in government reports. And in this, a few years ago, she's the one who found out that, KSM, that one terrorist, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, had been waterboarded. I forget how many times it was, like 130 times or something like that, which was a little detail that was in some of these reports that nobody picked up. But it just showed the astonishing level of torture they were using against these people.
Well,
and it's that kind of detail is so important in understanding these kinds of stories.
Right, and we'll have to invite her on the show. We'll talk about this later in the show because apparently the Washington Post changed some of their reporting on what the technology companies are actually able to do. And some journalists say they had to change it because they tried to get there first rather than to get the details that you just talked about. So kudos to Marcy Wheeler. Thanks for that, Tim. And what about you, David? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I want to second Tim and all independent journalists like Tim, Glenn Greenwald, my old colleague from Salon, Marcy, and others, because it's really the journalists in the independent culture who take these risks and get the information that is so vital in front of the American people. But I'm going to give a shout out to a very prestigious and mainstream publication, a very venerable one, the New England Journal of Medicine, which on Wednesday, and you can go to its website, called for the Navy doctors who were stationed at Guantanamo to mutiny against the force-feeding practices that are being imposed there on the prisoners who, are, of course, are in a lengthy hunger strike. And in a commentary in the New England Journal of Medicine, the physicians call that force-feeding on the part of the government and the Navy an assault on these prisoners. So to me, that was a brave act, a principled act for the New England Journal of Medicine to point out that Guantanamo, as they say, has become a medical ethics-free zone. So here to the New England Journal of Medicine.
Has it been picked up, do you know, by other outlets?
Well, I'm looking at right now a piece in the today's San Francisco Chronicle, buried inside, but nonetheless inside the Chronicle.
All right.
And it was an AP story.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. And we'll add links afterwards. Actually, over the years, psychologists and doctors have spoken out. But it sounds like, is this maybe the first time that
This is pretty confrontational for, such an authoritative medical journal to directly confront, U.S. policy on this. And as we all know, President Obama has the power to release many of these prisoners who have already been cleared today. But, of course, President Obama, in true fashion, is always trying to get buy-in from his Republican opponents and all that. Well, good luck with that. We need President Obama to do the right thing. He knows what the right thing is. And again, kudos to the New England Journal of Medicine for reminding him of what an ethical policy would be in Guantanamo.
All right. So we'll put a link to that story right after up on the website right after the show. And what about you, Justin? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, as an independent journalist myself, I give a big salute to journalists that report independently of different big media agendas. But this week, I have to salute actually the Wall Street Journal, who has a very good team of reporters based in Turkey, where I live, and they've been covering the Occupy Gezi protests very well from a number of different cities around the country. Their reporting has been consistent and generally just, I think, the best out there. So that's what I have to point out.
And specifically, what makes it the best?
I think it's really the sourcing. The Wall Street Journal recently opened up a Turkish language website in the country. This is going to potentially change the media landscape in the country because, as most people know, the media in Turkey is extremely censored. Journalists are not allowed to report in the ways that they might like to, lest they lose their jobs. But the Wall Street Journal is going to be translating every article that they publish in English on Turkey into Turkish. So we have all of a sudden in Turkey a website where everyone can log on to and see what's been written internationally about their country in their own language. And this is, as you can imagine, going to have a big effect on people who are currently demonstrating against the government when their own media is having to censor itself quite heavily.
Do other Western outlets have bureaus in Turkey?
You know, it's odd. There's actually not very many big Western media outlets that have established bureaus in Turkey. It's very difficult, actually, to establish a bureau in Turkey just logistically and in a bureaucratic sense, because the government watches media so closely. And the Wall Street Journal took the time over several years to really establish itself in Turkey. And after establishing a big office, hiring several local reporters, they even opened up a Turkish language site, which shows, I think, that they're very committed to the country and are willing to report not only just on the financial aspects of Turkey, which is a big emerging market, but then also the political side of things, which are often not quite as pleasant as the economic.
And doesn't McClatchy also have a bureau in Turkey?
McClatchy has a staff writer in Turkey who covers most of Europe and part of the Middle East from Istanbul. It doesn't have an entire bureau. The Wall Street Journal has an office and, you know, several reporters. McClatchy has one person that's based in Istanbul, another person that comes through Turkey to cover Syria. So we can't really say it has an actual bureau, unfortunately.
Hmm. David, it's interesting because a lot of these bureaus are basically one man or one woman shows, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, in general, of course, the corporate media has disinvested in foreign coverage in recent years as the whole business model for news has been shaken up. That was one of the first things to go. And, you know, just at the moment when the United States and American people needed to know more information about the world we live in, corporate media was cutting back on the coverage. So, you know, when I was at Salon, I mean, it was these brave individual freelancers and stringers who would pop up out of nowhere in the middle of war zones and everywhere in the world that we needed information, who were in the eye of the storm. And thank God.
Yeah. Well, and also, Tim, what's interesting, Jeremy Scahill's with a documentary he's in, Dirty Wars, opens in the Bay Area today, and I saw it a couple days ago. And, you know, the things that he uncovered about night raids, for example, and drones, I mean, you cannot get that story when you've got one reporter in a country, because in many cases, you've got to take like a four-hour truck ride, and your life could be in danger if the sun goes down and you don't get back to the main city. So, I mean, we're losing so much information as a result.
Right. I saw that film about a week ago here in D.C., and, you know, I found it an astonishing film and really, really very much worth seeing. And I think it's going to help change the conversation about, you know, these wars that we're fighting and how we do them. And you know, that's the thing is, like, you know, he's just one of these rare people who goes out there and, you know, he really wants to find out, you know, the human impact of our foreign policy and our war policies in places like Afghanistan, and finds out, you know, that special forces came in and attacked his village and, you know, killed a bunch of people and actually, you know, dug their bullets out of their bodies so they wouldn't be found later and you know, followed that trail. And there's just, you know, there just aren't very many people, any journalists really out there doing that kind of reporting and then going to other countries to see what else, you know, our special forces are doing. So that's, you know, that's really, really important work.
Yeah, we, you know, Rose, we live in this era of an imperial war, of remote control war. You know, when I was growing up watching the Vietnam War on television, we got more information visually when I was a kid about that war than the American people do today. So I think Tim makes a very important point. Brave independent journalists like Jeremy Scahill, who put themselves in the line of danger to report back to the United States citizens the information that's vital. What is it like on the ground, these dirty wars that are being fought in our name as American citizens?
And Justin, what brought you to Istanbul? Because you live there now and you're covering Turkey full time.
Right. I'm an independent journalist based in Istanbul. I write for a number of international publications. At first, the reason why I moved there was, you know, simply to be close to the Middle East and to, you know, live in a big city that was somewhat cosmopolitan, I suppose. That's, you know, very kind of, perhaps that sounds silly, but that's the reason why I chose Istanbul out of everywhere else. I never expected that the region would suddenly be going through much upheaval, and I just out of coincidence found myself, you know, reporting on, you know, a year after I moved there, reporting on the conflict in Syria, and then Turkey's own upheaval, which people have seen in the past week to be quite serious.
So give us an update on what's happening over the past couple of weeks. We had you on last week talking about the situation, which was escalating at that time. Five people have been killed so far. Thousands have been injured. What is the latest after 2 weeks of widespread protests?
It's not stopping. The Prime Minister, Mr. Erdogan, tried to offer a concession late last night. He called in organizers of the demonstrations that began in Istanbul into an office in Ankara, the capital, and he said that the construction project that they had initially been protesting, which spurred these mass anti-government demonstrations around the country, would go on hold for a time until a court made a decision about them. And he also offered to propose a referendum about how to develop central Istanbul. But the issue now is that the protests have grown much, you know, more. They've grown into something much more than just about Istanbul and just about how to develop the city. There has been a huge amount of anti-government sentiment brewing, you know, beneath the surface of the country for years now, and you all of a sudden see that coming out. And the fact that, you know, five people have been killed, one of them was a police officer, is going to have a serious impact on the country. I was just earlier today, I'm talking to you from Ankara. I was just earlier today with the family of one of the protesters that was killed. He was in the middle of Ankara, and what happened was a policeman began beating another protester, and he tried to defend them, and he was killed. This family is extremely upset, and they are saying that they are going to continue to protest the government, and that the government has crossed a line. And that seems to be the main feeling here in Turkey, even after 2 weeks of this.
That is Justin Vella. He is an independent journalist based in Istanbul, Turkey. If you'd like to talk about media coverage of Turkey, Justin will be with us for just a few more minutes, so now would be a good time to call. And we're also going to do a show about Turkey on Monday to have a wider conversation just about the state of the government policies there. It's often propped up as the democracy of the Middle East, but, you know, what are the protesters saying about their country and just the policies that they're enduring? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. After the break, we will talk about media coverage of the NSA's spy programs and then the larger question about what this reveals about the current state of journalism with David Talbot, founder and former editor-in-chief of Salon. He's project director of the new venture Open America. We'll also talk about that after the break. And Tim Shorrock, investigative journalist and author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Outsourced Intelligence. David, you've been watching Turkey like the rest of us have, just in sort of the headlines, what you're hearing on the radio. What are your thoughts on coverage, and do you have any questions for Justin?
Well, I'm fascinated by how this battle has grown over a fight for physical turf, for physical space. In this digital age, when we're all kind of just floating in the ether, you know, there's this human need, it seems to me, all around the world for people to get together to push for their social needs. And, of course, we saw this with the Occupy movement in this country. So my question would be, to what extent do the protesters in Turkey feel some kind of affinity with these other street protests around the world?
I think that they feel a big affinity with these other kind of street protests around the world. They definitely see themselves in the same light as the Occupy Wall Street movement in the United States. But at the same time, I think that they realize that they're fighting something different than, it's not Occupy Wall Street exactly, and it's also not the Arab Spring in Turkey. Turkey is generally described as this country between East and West, between Europe and Asia. In that same light, the protests that are currently happening in Turkey are unique and somewhat in between what's happening in other areas of the world. On the one hand, they're fighting against what many of them feel to be a neoliberal capitalist system that does not respect workers' rights, that does not respect the rights of every person on the street. And on the other side, they feel that they're fighting dictatorship and real serious limitations to their personal freedom because their leader has certain religious beliefs that, they don't agree with.
And we've got a couple calls for you, Justin, about what's happening in Turkey. So let's hear from Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for an informative program. I have a question regarding the role of the Kemalist movement in the events in Turkey. After all, the party created by Kemal Atatürk dominated Turkish politics for, 80 years or so. And this is a party that has been diminished in recent years, in the last 10 years, by the Islamist party. And of course, the essence of the Kemalist movement was anti-clerical. So I'm wondering to what extent we are seeing a reaction to the gains achieved by the Islamist party. I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you very much for a good program.
Thank you. Justin?
But it was essentially a question about what kind of effect the Kemalist movement is having on the protests.
Yeah, and can you give us just a little of an overview of the Kemalist movement for listeners who aren't aware? And we're definitely going to talk more about this on Monday.
Sure. The Kemalist movement, or Kemalism, is an idea created by the founder of the modern Turkish Republic, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. And it was an idea that Turkey should look to the West, that it should be more European, and that there was a very clear distinction between secularism and religion, and that the government should be strictly secular. And in the past 10 years, you've had an Islamist government in power in Turkey who have very slowly eroded the power of the military in Turkey, who consider themselves to be kind of guardians of the idea that Turkey should be secular and looking to Europe.
Justin, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll get you can finish your response after the break, and then we also have one more phone call about Turkey. And we're going to talk in about 5 or so minutes about the NSA's spying programs and what this tells us about the state of journalism. We'll be back after this.
All of the stories that you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org, and they're also included in Your Call's weekly email newsletter. It's free and easy to sign up for. Go to yourcallradio.org and click on the email newsletter link. And you can highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, or you can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will have a wide-ranging conversation about Turkey, its government, and its policies. So if you have any questions about that, be sure to tune in on Monday. On Tuesday, we will talk about the Farm Bill, which recently passed the Senate. It's now on its way to the House. And we will talk about the nutritional aspects of the Farm Bill, specifically efforts to drastically cut funding for food stamps. On Wednesday, Holly Kernan will do a show about summer reading and books. And also, I'm not sure if you've heard, but Marcus Books, the oldest black-owned bookstore in San Francisco, is unfortunately at risk of closure. There are many online campaigns to save Marcus Books. You can find more information if you just type in Save Marcus Books. So we'll also talk about that on Wednesday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. Just a couple of minutes, we'll be speaking with Tim Shorrock, investigative journalist and author of Spies for Hire about the NSA's spying program, and David Talbot, founder and former editor-in-chief of Salon, director of the new venture Open America, and author of the book Season of the Witch. And we actually have a call from Max, who wanted to know about the Kemalist movement in Turkey, for Justin Vella, who's a freelance reporter based in Istanbul. So go ahead, Justin, finish your thought on that. And Max wanted to know more about the reaction.
Sure. I mean, I can't say that the Kemalist movement is exactly defining the current protests in Turkey. I say that there is a large number of people, even the majority of people, that are taking part in these anti-government protests might identify themselves with Kemalism and Kemalist values. But I think that the protests are much wider than simply the Kemalist people in Turkey that are taking to the streets.
All right. We're going to talk more in depth about this on Monday. So, Justin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Justin Vella is a freelance reporter based in Istanbul. And if you do have any more questions about Turkey, be sure to tune in on Monday. So now we're going to talk about coverage of the NSA's spying program. And this is kind of a simple question, but I think it's important. When an explosive story like this runs in The Guardian, a story broken by Glenn Greenwald, you know, how should the rest of the media react? Because in the old days, when we all watched 60 Minutes and our local news and then got the newspaper the next morning, if a publication broke a story like this, every other media outlet would say, ooh, you know, what can we add to it? What can we do to make it different? What else can we break? So, David, when a story like this breaks in The Guardian, how should media outlets respond? And how did they do?
Well, you saw some of this, and, you know, I think the New York Times has done a pretty good job of following on. I read the Times every morning. But what you really want to know more about is how extensive is the NSA kind of intelligence empire, not just the NSA, but other intelligence agencies in America. And, of course, I think, as Tim has done so well in reporting, it's the privatization of Big Brother that's particularly threatening as well. We're right here on the edge of Silicon Valley, of course, and to me, one of the most, I think, reprehensible aspects of the story that we're learning is the extent to which Google, Yahoo, Facebook, just about virtually every big digital giant has bought into the Big Brother program and is working closely with the government, except, and you have to give a shout out, I think, to Twitter. Twitter is among the very few digital companies that I'm aware of that has done some legal pushback against the government's efforts to grab people's records and accounts.
Have you seen many stories looking at the close relationship between the government and these tech companies? And we should say President Obama was here last weekend raising money from these very tech companies.
Well, Andrew Leonard, who's a good tech correspondent for Salon, has a piece in today's Salon that people should check out. As I said, the New York Times has done some decent coverage of that in the last few days. Tim would probably know more. He's been following this, I'm sure, very closely.
Yeah. What would you want? What do you want to add there, Tim?
Well, you know, maybe the Wall Street Journal, they've had some pretty good stories. They have a very good intelligence reporter who's been there for about 10 years, who really knows her stuff, and especially knows the NSA. But, you know, one thing I want to say about the, you know, Greenwald's report is that, you know, in the past, like, say, you know, during the 80s and around that, during the Cold War, basically, you know, when there was times when independent journalists broke incredible stories, not only independent, but, you know, like this reporter Webb for the San Jose Mercury News, you know, who broke a story about the Contra drug flow and how the CIA was working with Contras to bring in drugs, and it turned out to be true. And once someone got some incredible documents about U.S. role in supplying names to the Indonesian junta that took over in the 1960s and massacred like 500,000 communists and communist suspects in the 60s. And when those stories came out, the media, like New York Times, Washington Post, L.A. Times, all joined together to trash these reporters.
Yep. Yes.
And undo their story.
Yep.
I mean, Gary Webb eventually committed suicide. I mean, he was destroyed.
Well, and look what Bill Keller at the New York Times did to Julian Assange. I mean, here's Bradley Manning stepping forward with a huge treasure trove of important news material about, again, the hidden aspects of our war and war crimes that were being committed. And he initially brought those secrets to the Washington Post and the New York Times. They weren't interested. Finally, Julian Assange took the risk at WikiLeaks to put that material together in the form of news gold, and he brought it to the New York Times, and then they were interested in working with him. They worked with Julian Assange. They depended on him and his enterprise, and then they threw him under the bus. I mean, Bill Keller, the executive editor of the New York Times, took every opportunity after that to disparage, ridicule, make fun of Julian Assange. Even if you've seen this latest movie by Alex Gibney, We Steal Secrets, there's an editorial minion of Bill Keller making fun of Julian Assange for his personal hygiene, the way he dresses. Here's a guy who's been on the run from the government, right, for months and months and months. And excuse him if his personal hygiene isn't up to the standards of the New York Times.
Well, so you're bringing up a number of points here, because The Daily Show eviscerated the media for doing the same thing to Edward Snowden, to basically talk about his girlfriend and friendships and things that, really? I mean, do we need to know about this? Well, MSNBC's...
What I was going to say was...
Yeah.
What I was going to add to that was that, you know, aside from what David just said, I mean, you don't really see that kind of going into someone's story and sort of, you know, showing how wrong it is and, you know, basically putting out the U.S. official point of view in the press. But you do see, you know, like the Times has followed up. I mean, people have clearly had stories in the bank that they've been working on, and then suddenly there's this deluge of stories. And this is one of those moments when, you know, there's incredible amounts of stuff starts coming out. Everyone wants to get their material out that they've been working on and you know, been, you know, trying to, trying to confirm and that kind of thing. And it's really kind of nice to see. But again, you know, I'll go back to the independent press that David was talking about originally. I mean, look, you know, I reported in 2007 in Salon that 70% of the intelligence budget goes to contractors. Hardly anybody picked up that story then. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, denied by the intelligence agencies. And a couple of years later, they finally gave a press conference and said, yes, in fact, that is the percentage. That is how much we spend. Still, many people didn't jump on it. But it took, you know, I did, all my stories appeared in the independent media. They were, you know, the Nation ran some of them. Salon, over a period of time, ran a whole bunch of stories I did, including the first major story about Booz Allen being, you know, a key intelligence contractor, and that was also 2007. You know, pointing out that Bush's appointee as head of intelligence was a man named Michael McConnell, who then was, you know, went from Booz to the Office of Director of National Intelligence. He'd been National Security Agency Director before.
Yeah, so look,
they just haven't paid attention, and now suddenly, you know, there's a deluge of stories.
Yeah.
You know, about this.
There's a two-track strategy. I think Tim's right. On the one hand, the mainstream media suddenly follows behind the bravery of these independent journalists and these whistleblowers. And number two, then they start throwing them under the bus because they're almost embarrassed by the fact that they've been outshone by these independents. And, you know, again and again, this happens. I mean, even like back in the 1970s when Daniel Shore at CBS was bravely breaking stories about the CIA around the time of the congressional investigations, he was finally thrown under the bus by his own company, CBS, and he ended up,
right,
of course, working for NPR. So that's why we need organizations like Open America, which I've started. We need to protect these brave independent journalists. We need to bring together responsible whistleblowers with investigative journalists who are brave enough to get their stories out. And you need to give them some legal protection, and you need to give them some editorial editorial support.
So are you surprised at the reaction? I mean, it's one thing when MSNBC's Joe Scarborough calls Snowden a weasel and says that Glenn Greenwald's reporting is misleading. But then you've got someone like The New Yorker's Jeffrey Toobin, who covers the Supreme Court, who says that, or who wrote that Edward Snowden is a, quote, grandiose narcissist who deserves to be in prison.
That's absurd. And Jeffrey Toobin, who I generally respect in many cases for his work as a journalist, should be ashamed of himself. I mean, I think he'll live to be ashamed of that quote in years from now. Edward Snowden, from all everything we know at this point, is a brave, modest, credible young man who knew the enormous risk he was taking, but said, as I, you know, quoting him from the interview he did afterwards, I no longer wanted to live in a society where these sorts of things could happen. That's the kind of moral soul searching that every American needs to start doing right now. Our democracy,
absolutely,
our freedoms are at risk. And a young man like Edward Snowden, who threw away everything, he threw away a $200,000 a year career. He was, living comfortably in Hawaii, in paradise, literally. And yet he took that risk and literally threw away everything for American democracy, for the people's right to know.
That's
right.
That is David.
I want to add to this. A couple days ago in the Wall Street Journal, there's this real right winger that writes for them, writes a column for them named James Taranto. And he accused me in this article of red baiting the NSA, which was one of the most silliest things I've ever heard, because I compared our surveillance state to the Stasi in East Germany. And my point was, we have 500,000 contractors with security clearances and 1.5 million government workers with security clearances. And so we have this huge percent of our population spying on the other part of the population. And that's what I was comparing to the Stasi. But like people in mainstream can't take that kind of comparison, and they attack you for even hinting that we may be living in a state that's growing close to authoritarian state.
And it's not just right wingers, as you point out, Rose.
No.
I mean, we're looking at liberals, we're looking at Democrats, moderates, who are all attacking the people's right to know. I mean, at this point, they're attacking journalists. Peter King, the congressman, has called for the prosecution of journalists like Glenn Greenwald. It's killing the messenger. And at this point, the last, line of defense that the American people have against an authoritarian state is these messengers, these brave whistleblowers and journalists who are coming forward. Official power, government always leaks. We should, remind your listeners of this. When we're talking about leaking and traitors and so on, the government, people in power in Washington, in the Senate, in Congress, in all these secret agencies, they're constantly leaking official secrets that they think will make them look better. What we're talking about is going around that bureaucracy and going directly to people that have information that has not been stamped with the approval of the government, that information that's vital to the American people.
And California Senator Dianne Feinstein has called Snowden a traitor. Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi says that he should be prosecuted. We've got about 15 or so, 10 minutes left. We'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on media coverage? It's receiving extensive coverage. What have you learned over the past 2 weeks? What have you not learned? And then based on what you've read and heard, what does this tell you about the current state of the media today? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Tim Shorrock is an investigative journalist, author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Outsourced Intelligence. You can find his pieces at yourcallradio.org. The latest ones, A Modern-Day Stasi State and Meet the Contractors Analyzing Your Private Data. David Talbot is project director of the new venture Open America, an investigative media project dedicated to a free, democratic, and transparent United States. David's got an article at Salon, where he's formerly editor-in-chief, called The Only Way to Keep Power Honest is to Keep Its Operations Visible. And let's hear from David in Brisbane. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hello?
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, yes. I wanted to ask a question. I heard over the years there's an arms race in the computer industry who can make the biggest computer. Jaron Lanier or whatever was on your show last week saying that the bigger computer it is, the more it pulls everybody else's data stream in. It's kind of basically wins their revenues and so on. And so I wanted to apply that to the fact the Chinese came and started negotiating with us informally about stopping their cyber attacks right when we have the Utah database coming up and all this exposure about the qubit quantum computers that are sitting at all the switching boxes and all this sophistication that we have. Is it possible we have just seen another, like, you know, end of the Cold War, you know, when the stealth bomber or the stealth, you know, that kind of, is there something happening with China and the United States over this NSA kind of environment? That was what I wanted to ask.
Thank you. David?
Well, of course, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall in that meeting in Palm Springs between the leaders of our respective countries. But, no, I think what I'm hearing from China right now is, you know, they're pointing out the hypocrisy and the double standard of the United States. Here we've been now for months and months attacking China for its so-called cyber espionage, and I'm sure that there's some legitimate concerns that we have there. But at the same time, as China is now pointing out, with these new NSA revelations, the biggest snoop in the world is the United States of America. So
let me add that, you know, these intelligence contractors that are involved with NSA surveillance, they're also the same companies, Booz Allen, SAIC, Northrop Grumman, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They're the same companies involved in cybersecurity for the NSA, and they're actually involved in, you know, offensive cyber operations, and they talk about it. You can go to, say, a company like CSC, which is one of the largest companies in the intelligence industrial complex and actually owns the internal IT of the NSA, which was privatized a few years ago, about 10 years ago. That company is deeply involved in offensive cyber attacks. And so, you know, these companies are part of this. And I think when we talk about either cybersecurity or, you know, NSA surveillance, all these intelligence contractors are deeply in the middle of it and engaged at the very highest levels. And, you know, one of the things that I think has really been missed in the press coverage of the NSA story is that, you know, like some people focus on, you know, like, why is this young guy getting this, you know, access to all these secrets and documents? Well, my question is, why is a company like Booz Allen Hamilton operating at the very highest levels and deepest levels of the NSA?
Absolutely. And just one other quick point that the New York Times piece on this pointed out last week, talking about the collusion between Washington and Silicon Valley. This blew my mind. At one point, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff visited Silicon Valley, sat down in corporate meetings with Google and other major Silicon Valley companies to plot their strategy for surveillance. I mean, this is, you know, Big Brother taken, you know, 2.0 at this point.
Well, and the other thing, just quickly, and we'll get to a few calls. I mean, there's so much obsession on the budget and, you know, so-called food stamp fraud and this kind of thing. But according to the Project on Government Oversight, the federal government spends over $500 billion a year on outside contractors. And in POGO's 2011 report, it says, our study found that the government has failed to determine how much money it saves or wastes by outsourcing, insourcing, or retaining services and has no comprehensive system for doing so. I mean, Tim, if we're talking about $500 billion, where is the oversight and where's the coverage on that?
There isn't any, basically. I mean, there's been one hearing, I think, in Congress on intelligence contracting since 9/11 and since this huge expansion of the intelligence budget, and it was a pathetic hearing. They have actually, the Senate committee consulted with me before they did the hearing and asked me for some advice, and of course they didn't take any of mine. I told them, you know, you should bring on the heads of these companies and let the American people meet the private sector directors of our intelligence, so they know that who these people are. But they just, you know, had this sort of desultory hearing and just it was very vague and, you know, didn't raise anything. And, you know, that's the Congress has this oversight, responsibility, which they've completely failed at. And there was the most astonishing statement 2 days ago by Senator Feinstein, who said, you know, she was shocked to know that there were so many intelligence contractors. And I'm like, wait a minute, she's the chairwoman of the Senate Intelligence Committee,
wow.
And she's saying this?
I mean, of course she knows this. You know, they've buried it. And these things, you know, the contracting is buried beneath the veil of secrecy. And what I've learned in reporting on a lot of these stories is that lots of the, the subcontracts folded into subcontracts, the agencies can hide all kinds of secret programs in contracts and subcontracts. So it's almost beyond the oversight.
And beyond Tim's great reporting, of course, you had Dana Priest at the Washington Post, doing a series of articles on the privatization of surveillance, and that became a book, and that became a PBS documentary. So for Senator Feinstein, to plead ignorance is a little, stretches the imagination.
Wow.
You know, I was going to make one other point, Rose, about, this new secrecy state. They keep claiming, of course, that this is for our own good, mm-hmm. for our own protection. But in reality, this umbrella, this dark umbrella they put over information in this country through classification procedures and so on, it goes back years, goes back decades. We're not talking about the war on terror. We're talking about the Cold War. Speaking of what Tim said, the Stasi, the East German intelligence. So in other words, secrets related to the Kennedy presidency and the president's assassination are still being withheld in violation of federal law by the CIA. There's over 1,100 key documents, and this is a project that Open America is going to be focusing on. The CIA promised to release those documents by the 50th anniversary of the president's death, which we're now very close to coming to in November of this year. But they're defying, once again, the American people's right to know, and they're now saying, no, we're not going to show you those 1,100 documents. Well, this is our right to this history, and this has nothing to do with national security. It's a cover-up, pure and simple.
So, David, you're starting this new project, Open America, and there are so many amazing outlets out there like ProPublica, California Watch, Center for Investigative Reporting. And if you follow them and you have the time to follow them, there's some great journalism out there. What I find is that they don't get elevated and they don't get shared on Facebook. And so then they kind of wither away. How are you going to deal with that?
Well, for one thing, we're going to be a little more aggressive, I think, than some of those organizations. They do great work, as you say, many of these investigative organizations, but they're funded in many cases by wealthy individuals, by foundations. They have to be a little more cautious. We're going to push the envelope. Hmm. You really have to, I think, be as aggressive as possible in today's climate to get the truth out. And we're going to do that, working with lawyers, of course, and with whistleblowers. We're not going to be irresponsible about this. We're going to bring, very tough editorial criteria to these different scoops that we release. But look, at this point, we're in a fight, as I was saying earlier, a fight for America and the soul of American democracy. And no one can afford to sit on the sidelines anymore. So as journalists, we're going to get into the fray, we're going to get into the arena, and we're going to work with brave whistleblowers and get the truth out.
What holes do you want to fill?
Well, number one, our history, like I was saying, vital information about the Kennedy presidency and the assassination that is still being withheld, those documents. We want to push for their release, even if it comes to working with whistleblowers on that. And number two, the drone war. President Obama has promised to now focus that war. He realizes many of much of the downside of that we might have created more enemies than we've actually eliminated with the drone campaign. But we need to know the legal protocols for what rationalizes those drone strikes. Even the legal protocols that are being used by the White House to justify those attacks, they're secret. I mean, this is absurd. American people have no ability to make informed decisions about their democracy, about wars that are being carried on in their name without this information.
Yeah, and what about that question about democracy, Tim? Are you seeing much coverage out there that focuses on what these programs say about democracy in the United States?
Very little. No one's really asking the central question is, what are the implications of these private sector companies doing? And one thing I want to say and get back to something we talked about at the very beginning, which is the role of whistleblowers. 2 months ago, I published a cover story in The Nation magazine about Tom Drake, Bill Binney, and the other two NSA whistleblowers who exposed this incredibly corrupt program at the NSA called Trailblazer that privatized the analysis of signals intelligence, cost the country $6 or $7 billion in wasted money, never produced
an iota of intelligence. And according to these whistleblowers, because of that, it was we didn't have a proper system in place before 9/11 to track people who might be planning an attack like that. And it's a very serious charge. But that story only came out because of these whistleblowers, and they went through the channels. They went to the Office of Inspector General of the Pentagon and reported this corruption. And then what happened was they were caught up in the investigation of the NSA, the leaking of the story to the New York Times about warrantless surveillance, and they were all investigated. Tom Drake was indicted under the Espionage Act, charged with being a spy. And so, you know, their lives are ruined. They all had to leave, and you know, they're basically, you know, they were just taken out of the they were ruined. I mean, they were attacked. You know, Tom almost went to jail. And you know, this is why one of the reasons Snowden, I mean, he saw what happens to whistleblowers even when they go through legal channels. And so he took the opportunity to, you know, to leave the country and you know, get these secrets out. But the value of whistleblowers is so critical. I mean, I just can't emphasize it more.
Yeah, because the legal channels often are blocked to journalists
and the public.
More about
that story than, you know, anybody.
And 30 seconds, David, where should this story go from here?
Well, we need more information. We need this national debate that President Obama has promised. Let's all get engaged in that debate. Now, he may not like where the debate goes, but we need pushback from the people. We need pushback from brave journalists and from whistleblowers. That's why I started Open America. Please go to the Indiegogo page that we started to help contribute. We are off to a great start, but need to hit our goal. We will sponsor 3 very hard-hitting investigative projects with that money. So, you know, vote with your money
and
in that case.
No corporate funding, right?
No corporate funding. That's why we're going directly to the American people.
David Talbot is project director of the new venture Open America. You can also find more information at yourcallradio.org. He's author of the new book Season of the Witch. Tim Shorrock, investigative journalist and author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Outsourced Intelligence. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What's behind the recent protests in Turkey? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the ruling party AKP and its policies. The brutal attacks on peaceful activists in Istanbul's Gezi Park have ignited a mass anti-government protest. Over 4,000 people have been injured. Thousands have been arrested. Turkey is heralded as a model for democracy in the Middle East. Protesters say it's an authoritarian state. So what do you want to know about the Turkish government? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.